The book of Esther is part of a scroll called the Megillah, which was a scroll of five books. Each book was read at a specific time and is still read at a specific feast in Israel. The Song of Solomon was a book that the Jews read at Passover. The book of Ruth is read at Pentecost. The book of Lamentations, the feast of the destruction of the temple. The book of Ecclesiastes is read at the Feast of Tabernacles, and the Feast of Esther, on the Feast of Purim, the book of Esther is read. Now we're going to, if we get far enough, discuss what the Feast of Purim is. It's a scriptural feast. It's in this book. It's discussed, it's described, and yet not a lot of people know about it. Esther is a crisis book. It shows that God is the God of crises as well as good times, and that He has stuff in control. That you never get into a situation that is too tough for God to maintain control over. The book of Esther introduces us to a crisis. And then the last half of the book, chapter 6 through 10, the crisis is overruled by God's providence. So we're introduced in the first few chapters to a horrible situation, a possible extermination of the Jewish race. And then we see how God overrides it. Now, the interesting thing about Esther is that the name of God is not found in it once. And this has caused a disgruntling among many people, especially those who aim at higher criticism, which usually doesn't do people much good. Trying to find reasons why the Bible is not true, basically. And they say, well, since the name of God is not written in this book, then it's not to be considered a biblical book. In fact, Martin Luther himself wished that the book never had been written. Well, he said that about the book of James, too, so I discredit Martin Luther for saying that. But just the fact that God's name isn't written doesn't mean that God isn't in the book. See, that's the beauty of the book of Esther, is that we're worried about what isn't there. You know, what is there is that God shows up, and we see providence, we see sovereignty. And I think that God's name is withheld on purpose from this book, because God is silently moving behind the scenes. Lightning doesn't burst. Visions don't occur. No spectacular, miraculous events as we would call them, but God's overriding providence works out the normal events of humanity. That's what's so beautiful. As I was reading the book of Esther this week, I thought, Lord, I think it's beautiful that your name is withheld from this book. Because we can still see God even though His name doesn't appear. You could describe providence as God standing back in the shadows, amid the shadows, watching over His people. Esther shows us that while we cannot see God always, God always sees us. While we can't see Him readily, miraculously, we are never out of His sight. And so we'll discuss providence a little bit later on. We discussed providence a little bit this morning, and I don't want to overlap too much or say the same things. But oh, that Christians would realize that God is still in charge, that God is still in control, that the world never gets so bad that God gives up. This world, folks, is not out of control. It's going along a time schedule perfectly, as God has foreordained. As to the physical universe, God has worked in three basic ways. First of all, creation. He created the worlds. He spoke them into existence. Secondly, He maintains the world. It says in the book of Colossians that He keeps them by the word of His power. And third of all, there's providence. That is, God works out the events of the physical universe so that in the end, His will is accomplished. This is God's universe. He's running it. We're not. Let me read a portion of Scripture out of the book of Daniel. It's a classic on the providence of God. All the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing He does according to His will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. And no one can restrain His hand or say to Him, what have you done? Now, God works, and God does not have to report what He does to anybody. He doesn't have to give an account to you or I or explain to you or I why He does things. It is His universe. Fortunately, He does explain many things. He does tell us why He operates in the way He does, but not in all things. And He doesn't have to give an account. It's His universe. Paul says that God works all things according to the counsel of His own will. It's His plan. It's not always our plan. Our ways are not His ways. But in the shadows of humanity is God working out His will. As I have read the book of Esther, the Lord has impressed upon me to look for Him in the most unlikely situations. In those situations where I begin to cry out and say, oh God, where are you? It is in those times where God is perhaps a little more removed or in the shadows, and yet His hand of providence is working. And as I've read the book of Esther, I'm learning not to question God on issues as much as I have, but to let things rest, because I'm amazed as I read this book, God's timing. Now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus, this was the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces. Now some versions have taken the liberty to translate this Xerxes, which is his name, but that's not in the Hebrew text. Ahasuerus was the title given to Xerxes. It was not his name. His name is Xerxes. His title is Ahasuerus, like Caesar. He was he was called the King of Kings, and that's what the word Ahasuerus means. His name, Xerxes the First, the son of Artaxerxes. Remember Nehemiah chapters 1 through 4 where we're introduced to Artaxerxes Longimanus? It says that he reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces. In those days when King Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which is in Shushan, the citadel, that in the third year of the reign he made a feast for all his officials and servants, the powers of Persia and Media, the nobles and princes of the provinces being before him. Remember, at a specific time, as Daniel predicted, Nebuchadnezzar lost control of the kingdom, and eventually the Babylonian kingdom fell into the hands of the Medes and the Persians. It was Cyrus, who was the Persian king, who allowed the Jews freedom to go back to the homeland and rebuild the temple at Jerusalem. 50,000 Jews went back to Jerusalem with Ezra, or 48,000. A few more thousand, several years later, went back to Jerusalem with Nehemiah. So a total of about 50,000 Jews, at the command of Cyrus, left Persia. Now, if you're wondering, again, just to clarify it in your mind, why we're talking about Persia and not Babylon, is because the Persians captured the Babylonian kingdom. So now, as Daniel predicted, the Persians are in control of what Nebuchadnezzar once controlled, the whole known world. Ahasuerus was eccentric, and he is faced with a threat. Alexander the Great in the West is flexing his military muscles and trying to move his kingdom and expand his borders to the east. So there's a clash of east and west. Ahasuerus is trying to conquer the Greeks, and the Greeks are trying to conquer the Persian Empire. Because of this, Ahasuerus has all of his nobles from 127 provinces, which extended to from India down to Africa, included the Fertile Crescent, which Israel lay in, parts of Asia Minor, all the way extending into parts of Europe. All of these guys are gathered around for a six-month smorgasbord, one of the biggest feasts in history. Now, I'm adding some light from secular history because it's not in the narrative, but Ahasuerus is trying to sell a war plan. Because Greece poses a threat, Ahasuerus desires that all of the princes of the provinces will join him in fighting against the Grecian Empire so that they can have victory and maintain control of the world. So he's gathering people together for this long feast to persuade them to join him in this battle. Verse 4. When he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the splendor of his excellent majesty for many days, 180 days in all. And when these days were completed, that's 6 months, the king made a feast lasting 7 days for all the people who were present in Shushan, the citadel, from great to small, in the court of the guard of the king's palace. Now, as much as Ahasuerus is trying to keep control as emperor of the world, God is still in control. And because of God's control, as the prophet Daniel predicted, the Babylonian Empire will fall to the Medes and the Persians. The Medo-Persian Empire will fall to the Grecian Empire. And so as God predicted in Daniel, there will be a power shift from east to west. Now, why is this important as Christians? I'll tell you why. As you look at the God of history, you can't help but be amazed at how God pulls strings. It was important that there become a power shift from east to west, because as Alexander the Great conquered the known world and he put pockets of Greek culture in different parts of his world, he embarked on a fantastic system of building roads, and he desired that the whole known world speak one common language, and that was Greek. He pretty much succeeded in that. That was helpful for the setting of the New Testament, because the New Testament was written in the lingua franca of the days, which was Greek. And almost anyone could pick up a manuscript or a letter that Paul wrote and understand it. At the time of Christ and at the time of the early church, because of the Grecian influence, the world has resorted to one language, one common bounds of communication, and there's been an integral road system so that the Apostle Paul and many others could reach into parts of the world on foot so the gospel could be preached. That's why the scripture says, when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his only son, born of a virgin. Beautiful setting takes place. God is in control of history. Now look at the array. In verse 6, there were white and blue linen curtains fastened with cords of fine linen and purple on silver rods, marble pillars. Couches were of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of alabaster, turquoise, and white and black marble. And they served drinks in golden vessels. Forget the crystal, bring out the gold. Each vessel being different from the other, with royal wine in abundance according to the generosity of the king. In accordance with the law, the drinking was not compulsory. That is, they didn't make people get bombed. For the king had ordered all the officers of his household that they should do according to each man's pleasure. If a guy wants a drink, give him a drink. He doesn't have to have one, but if he wants one, whatever he desires. Sort of a ancient existentialism. Queen Vashti also made a feast for the women in the royal palace which belonged to Ahasuerus. According to the social customs, the women never dined or had a party with their husbands. It was always separated. The men would go over here, the women would go over here. Now, Ahasuerus is trying to sell his princes on war. No time for women to hang out. Women have their own time. And so the queen, Queen Vashti, gets all of the women of the princes, and she has her own shindig. It's interesting, if you travel to some eastern countries, even to this day, there is still separation, even in Christian areas. When I was in Thailand doing a pastor's conference, the woman would come and serve the men first, and they would be behind, kind of watching from a distance to make sure everything was okay. I made a mistake in trying to, give one of the women a seat on the ground. We were all just all sitting in the dirt eating. And I said, well, come on here, you eat first. And all the men looked at me like I committed the unpardonable sin, you know. Because according to the social custom, and you're not going to break that by rebuking them and telling them that they're a bunch of chauvinist pigs. It's just not going to turn Thailand around in a pastor's conference. So the women would watch, they would serve us after we were pleasantly packed, they would sit down and eat what's left. On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, that is, he was a little bit tipsy, He commanded all of these people in verse 10 to bring Queen Vashti before the king, wearing her royal crown in order to show her beauty to the people and officials, for she was beautiful to behold. This was something that was just uncustomary. You didn't do that. It was almost sacrilegious to bring a woman in the midst of a party of men. He wanted to display her. Look how beautiful my woman is. And just have her kind of parade around for the men. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's commandment. At the king's command, brought by his eunuchs, therefore the king was furious, and his anger burned within him. Ahasuerus, according to secular history, was known for having really strange fits of anger. At one point, he had a bridge built, and 300 men built this bridge. The bridge was in nice shape, but before the bridge was completed and had enough materials to strengthen it sufficiently, there arose a storm at sea that busted the bridge. It destroyed some of the fleets, some of the ships of Ahasuerus, as well as the bridge. Ahasuerus was so incensed. Now, listen to this sane man. He went down to the ocean and he started beating the waves of the sea for taking the lives of his men and destroying his ships. Getting angry at the sea. You dumb sea! Then he put to death the 300 men who built the bridge. So you don't want to make a guy angry like this. He's just the kind of guy who would look and say, go ahead, make my day. Now it's time to meet with his cabinet members. This is a tough thing. His wife has disobeyed him. Didn't know how to handle it. And the king said to the wise men who understood the times, for this was the king's manner toward all who knew law and justice, those closest to him being all of these people who had access to the king's presence and who ranked highest in the kingdom, what shall we do to Queen Vashti according to law? Because she did not obey the commandment of King Ahasuerus, brought to her by the eunuchs. Now this guy Memucan is the chief spokesman, and I have a feeling he was a little henpecked at home. He's awfully defensive when it comes to how women should be treated and how men should be treated, and he was probably the kind of guy who thought, I can just hear it now. If we don't do something to this queen, I can't go home. My wife is going to have a heyday with this. She's already nagging at me. And so he kind of becomes a spokesman and takes up the reins for the rest of the folks. He says, Queen Vashti has not only wronged the king, but also all of the princes and all the people who are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. He's making a real big deal out of it. Now, this is not just a domestic problem, king, but this is going to affect the whole world. Getting a little melodramatic. For the queen's behavior will become known to all women, so they will despise their husbands in their eyes. When they report, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought in before him, but she did not come. This very day, the noble ladies of Persia and Media will say to all the king's officials that they have heard of the behavior of the queen. Thus, there will be excessive contempt and wrath. So he tries to avert a woman's liberation movement. He's real scared of what feminism would do to the kingdom. And so they get together and they opt that the queen should be booted out of office. Kick her out. Now there was, in the legal system of Media and Persia, irrevocable laws. That is, once a king decided on something and took his ring, which formed the seal, it had engraved the little seal of the entire empire, he would take his ring and he would smash it in some soft wax, and that wax was hardened. That was the signet ring, and that was sort of his John Doe on a document. When he would put his signet ring in that wax, it meant, what I have written, it can never be revoked. Even the king himself could not go back and say, I've changed my mind. At least they just didn't do that, except in one instance, and that's what we read toward the end of this book. And so, this guy, what's his name? Memucan, advises the king to boot Vashti out of office. and she gets kicked out. Now, chapter 2, there's been a time gap between chapter 1 and chapter 2. This is what happened. Ahasuerus went out to war and fought against the Greeks at the Battle of Thermopylae. He was sure that he could win because the Persians had one advantage over the Greeks. Their advantage is that they had more men. Their armies were much, much bigger than that of the Greeks. However, in Greek warfare, the Greeks really trained the individual so that one Greek soldier was worth about 10 Persian soldiers. And they could do what Persians could not do. They really were high-trained, highly motivated individuals. So, in essence, although the Greeks were smaller number, the Greek army was much better army than the Persians. Ahasuerus won the support of his 120 princes from the provinces, went out to battle against the Greeks, but he lost the battle. Now he comes back home. Queen Vashti is kicked off the throne. He's all alone. He's in very low spirits. And who knows what a king like this, what he's been known to do, could do. And yet, again, God is in the background pulling the strings. It was God's will that he lose the battle. It was God's will that eventually the Greeks take over the known world, become rulers, become the world governing empire, as predicted by the prophet Daniel, to set the stage for the coming of Jesus Christ. After these things, when the wrath of King Ahasuerus subsided, he remembered Vashti, what she had done, and what had been decreed against her. And the king's servants who attended him said, "Let beautiful young virgins be sought for the king, and let the king appoint officers in the provinces of the kingdom, that they may gather all of the young or the beautiful young virgins to Shushan," which is his principal city of governing, "the citadel," the fortress, "into the woman's quarters under the custody of Hegai, the king's eunuch, custodian of the women, and let beauty preparations be given them. Then let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti." This thing pleased the king, and he did so. In other words, they said, "King," they're trying to get his mind off of his defeat. "Look, you don't have a queen anymore." He had a harem, he had concubines, but he didn't have a queen. And they're saying, "Now, you need a new woman. You need a wife. Get some of these young ladies. Let's have a beauty contest. They can come and parade themselves. We'll prepare them, and you choose for yourself a queen." And he liked the idea. Then the young woman who pleased the king be queen instead of Vashti. This thing pleased the king, and he did so. Now in Shushan the citadel, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, or if you prefer the Hebrew pronunciation, Mordechai. Let's just say Mordecai, we're Americans. The son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. Kish had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captives who had been conquered with Jeconiah, the king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. There were three deportations of Jews into Babylon. The first deportation, where they took Jews from Jerusalem and transplanted them in Babylon, was when Nebuchadnezzar decided to take all of the men of noble character, the upper class. That's when Daniel and his three friends were taken to Babylon. The second deportation was when King Jeconiah was in charge of Jerusalem, and they took the middle class citizens. The last deportation is when Jerusalem was totally leveled, and they took a few of the slaves and all of the poor people they let remain in Jerusalem. And Mordecai brought up Hadassah, that is Esther. Hadassah is her Hebrew name. It means myrtle. I shared this with Gina today. I said, "Do you know what Hadassah means?" He said, "No, what?" I said, "Myrtle." He said, "No wonder she changed her name to Esther." That is Esther, which means star, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman was lovely and beautiful. When her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So it was when the king's command and decree were heard, and when many young women were gathered at Shushan the citadel under the custody of Hegai, that Esther also was taken to the king's palace into the care of Hegai, the custodian of the woman. Now, this is a beauty contest, basically. This is the first recorded beauty contest that we know of. Although there is the providence of God, and God is overruling. What Mordecai did was wrong. It was forbidden by Jewish law for a Jew to marry a pagan. I am not excusing Mordecai. I am not even looking at him as some godly individual. And I'm not going to spiritualize the story by saying, oh, he was praying day in and day out and God gave him a vision to put her in a beauty contest. I think that they were in an apathetic state, a state of being backslidden. They hadn't returned with the rest of the Jews to Jerusalem. They were hanging out in comfort in an enemy territory. And they were not given over to God's laws. However, God is still in control to preserve the Jewish race. See, that's the key of the whole book, is divine providence working behind. Here's the reason that Esther was in a real dangerous position. If she lost the beauty contest, if she did not become the queen, all of the women who lost were put into the king's harem and they became concubines. So she would be reduced to that of a slave, a sexual slave, for a pagan king. Verse 10. Esther had not revealed her people or her kindred. That is, she didn't tell anybody that she was a Jew. For Mordecai charged her not to reveal it. And every day Mordecai placed in front of the court of the woman's quarters to learn of Esther's welfare, what was happening to her. Now I can see old Mordecai biting his fingernails, worrying. Oh, I hope she wins it, because if she doesn't, she's going to be in the concubine, the harem, the concubine harem of the king. When a person is in the will of the Lord and makes a choice knowing that he's performed God's will, he never has to act like this. He never has to worry and fret. He can lay his laurels down, knowing that whatever happens, God's will be enacted because he's been obedient. But when a person is out of the will of God and acting in disobedience and not really sure if he's obeying the law of God or not, you better believe he's going to worry day in and day out and wonder if everything's going right. Verse 12 is interesting. Each young woman's turn came in to go to King Ahasuerus after she completed 12 months preparation according to the regulations for the women. For thus were the days of their preparation appointed, 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with perfumes and preparations for beautifying women. Now, men, don't complain if your wife spends a few hours at the beauty salon. These ladies spent a year at the beauty salon. 6 months in the spa and having lotions rubbed on them, and 6 months swimming in perfume. A year of beauty preparations. It's interesting to note that in a pagan culture like this, the emphasis upon the physical person. So much emphasis is placed upon beautifying the individual. Now, I am not down on makeup. And I'm not going to be an extremist saying, thou shalt not wear makeup or wear pantsuits. And I know that some people maintain that position. But you can be an extremist on the other end. You can spend so much time on the physical, on this tent that is passing away. And at least I would only ask for equity. Tally up all of the time that you spend in front of a mirror. And at least give that to the Lord in prayer and Bible study. If you spend that much time on the physical beauty, at least spend the same amount of time on nurturing the inner man and the inner woman. And hey, this goes for men too. I watched the other night on the news how that it's a big deal now for men to get facelifts and plastic surgery. No one's satisfied with the way they look. And that's really interesting. People in general are not satisfied with their physical appearance. I went into a barber shop, or into a beauty salon, as they call them now. To me, it's just a barber shop. I was getting a haircut. And these people were coming in, and the girls, well, let me just say, the people, to be as generic as I can without offending anyone, those who had curly hair didn't like it. They wanted straight hair. Those who had straight hair wanted a perm because they wanted curly hair. Those who were blonde wanted darker hair, and those who had darker hair wanted blonde hair. Those who had short hair wanted longer hair, and the long-haired ones wanted shorter hair. No one was satisfied. And I asked her, I said, does anyone like their hair? And she said, you know what? That's really interesting. No one usually likes their own appearance. And so we spend so much money trying to improve it, which in some cases is not a bad idea. But listen to 1 Peter. 1 Peter says, do not let your beauty be that outward adorning of arranging the hair, of wearing gold, or of putting on fine apparel. But let it be the hidden person of the heart, with the incorruptible ornament of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in the sight of God. Now, he's not saying, don't wear makeup. He's saying, let your focus be upon the spiritual woman and the spiritual man. That's what's most important. Man, I've met some of the most beautiful women who outwardly, many wouldn't consider beautiful women, but their beauty shines because of the inward heart. It shines through. It's so beautiful. And you're around people like that, and it's, oh, how beautiful. When I was first dating my wife, Lenya, the first thing that attracted me to her was her physical beauty. I thought, she's cute. I like her. She's pretty. And we dated. We broke up for a couple years. When I dated her again, the thing that struck me was her spiritual beauty, as she had grown so much in the Lord. And I thought, this woman is beautiful inside. Now, again, don't get bummed out at yourself if you wear makeup. You know, in some cases, it's, well, let's go on. I'm not going to touch that baby anymore. But some people ask me, well, should women wear makeup? My answer is, it depends. I'm not going to tell you on what. Depends on what you want to do. How's that? Thus prepared, each young woman went to the king, and she was given whatever she desired to take in with her from the woman's quarters to the king's palace. In the evening she went, and in the morning she returned to the second house of the woman to the custody of Shazgaz, or Shashgaz, the king's eunuch who kept the concubines. She would not go into the king unless the king delighted in her and called for her by name. Now when the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his daughter to go into the king, she requested nothing but what Haggai, the king's eunuch, the custodian of the woman, advised. And Esther obtained favor in the sight of all who saw her. Evidently, this counselor told her that she didn't need all of the rigmarole and all of the makeup and preparation, that just to limit her preparation, she obviously was a woman of much natural beauty. And because of her natural beauty, this guy said, look, I think you're fine the way you are. And she went in as she was before the king. So Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace. In the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign, the king loved Esther more than all the other women. And she obtained grace and favor in his sight, more than all the virgins. So he set the royal crown, the diadem, upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king made a great feast, the feast of Esther, for all of his officials and servants, and he proclaimed a holiday in the provinces and gave gifts according to the generosity of a king. In some translations, it indicates that there was even a withholding of taxes for an entire year to celebrate this new queen, Queen Esther, being on the throne. Be great, man, wouldn't it, after every election, if they just hold off taxes for a year? Just to celebrate, I'm for that. When virgins were gathered together a second time, Mordecai sat within the king's gate. Now, we have a change a little bit in leadership. That is, now Mordecai, who is behind the scenes, is slowly coming out in the open. He's now sitting in the gate. It could be that a little nepotism is going on here. Now that Esther has reached the throne, maybe she's using her pull to get Mordecai promoted a little bit. Because being in the gate of the city, or the king's gate, meant that he was a judge. You know, I wish I could recreate for you what a courtroom scene was like in ancient Israel. You almost have to go there to see. They didn't have courtrooms. They didn't have a judge sitting behind a wooden desk with a robe on and hitting a hammer on the desk. The courtroom was the city gate. The elders gathered at the gate. If you had a case that you wanted to dispute, you'd hang out at the gate. All the men hung out at the gate, by the way. In ancient times, the women did all the work. The women plowed the fields. The women milked the goats, took them out for feeding. Among the Bedouins today, it's the same exact idea. When I spent a day in a Bedouin's tent last time I was in Israel. And I went to the Bedouin's tent, and all the men were hanging around sleeping, drinking coffee. Some of them were drinking coffee, some of them were sleeping. I said, "Where's your wives?" And they pointed out into the fields, and the wives were out there working. The men in ancient times hung out at the city gate. They did the more important work, like discussing things, talking about the affairs of the world and how they were going to solve the world's problems. Remember when Boaz wanted to have the right of redemption for Ruth, he went to the city gate. Lot was a keeper of the gate at Sodom. That is, he was a politician, a judge in control of the affairs of Sodom. So Mordecai has been promoted a little bit. He's now a judge, acting city judge in Shushan. And Esther had not yet revealed her kindred and the people, just as Mordecai had charged her, for Esther obeyed the command of Mordecai as when she was brought up by him. Now this is interesting. Even though she's married and she's the queen, she's obeying Mordecai, the guy who raised her. A real respect for those who brought her up. Now in those days when Mordecai sat within the king's gate, two of the king's eunuchs, Bigthan and Teresh, doorkeepers, became furious and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. Oh, this was typical. It was so unsafe to be a ruler in ancient times. Everybody was either your enemy or your friend. There was no middle ground. And if they were your enemy, they sought to snuff you, kill you. Now, do you remember from our previous studies the one office that was held to ensure safety for the king in Persia? What was it? What was it? Cupbearer. The one who tasted the wine. Because if anybody wanted to kill the king, they would usually poison the wine or the food. And so the king hired a cupbearer to taste the food and to taste the wine. If the cupbearer croaked, the king would know that a conspiracy is on. Thus, the cupbearer and the king had a very special relationship of trust. Now, so this matter became known to Mordecai, who told Queen Esther, and Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. And when an inquiry was made into the matter, it was confirmed, and both were hanged on a gallows. And it was written in the book of the Chronicles, that is, in the meeting, the minutes of the kingdom, the Chronicles, in the presence of the king. It has been said that big doors swing on little hinges. This little incident that we just read about is so important to the future of the Jewish nation. Mordecai discovers a plot. He rats on the two guys that want to kill the king. They get hung, but Mordecai does not get rewarded. No promotion. Perhaps Mordecai was thinking, now all that I have done, I played FBI agent, I got these guys snuffed out, I've worked hard, I risked my neck to save the king, and life goes on. He got no rewards yet. Later on in the book, he gets rewards. And when he gets rewarded for this incident, the entire story changes. It is at the right time. God is setting the stage providentially to get his will done. Remember that when you do something good and you aren't noticed for it. If you are a servant, if you major in unselfish living, most of your rewards will not be immediate. In fact, most of them will be when you die and go to heaven. If you're the kind of a person who always needs to be noticed and rewarded and stroked every time you do something good, servanthood is not for you. Most unselfish living goes unrewarded until the future. And God's hand lies behind the fact that he is not noticed nor rewarded, because when he is, it is the hand of God changing the fate of the Jewish nation. Man, when I read this, this is so exciting. Because I see that, as the writer once said, disappointments are his appointments. Take off the D and put an H. Disappointments are his appointments. God ordains them when you're a child of God. In his divine providence, God works out those disappointments to bring you to the perfect place and to prepare other people and other events for his glory. Now in chapter 3, we get a chapter that has been often duplicated in the life of the Jew. In my Bible, it's got a little title. It says, Haman's Conspiracy Against the Jews. You could take out Haman's name and you could put Pharaoh. You could put his name there. You could put Adolf Hitler's name there. You could put Nasser's name there. You could put Arafat's name there. The Jews have suffered more than any other people group that has ever been around. And for a very profound reason. Let's dig into it. After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite. Gag. Agagite. And advanced him and set his seat above all the princes who were with him. That's interesting. An Agagite. Now, why would the Holy Spirit go out of his way to tell us that he was an Agagite? Simply to show you the failure of one man named Saul. When Saul came back from the battle with the Amalekites, God told him, before he went, slay all of the Amalekites. Because if you don't, eventually, your disobedience will catch up with you. They will rise up, they will multiply, and your enemies will eventually pose a threat to you. Well, Saul was tender-hearted. He was Mr. Milquetoast. And he decided, instead of being so ruthless, that he would spare King Agag and some of his family. Because he spared some of the family of King Agag, his descendants went down through history. Instead of putting them away like God told them, they are now posing a threat to exterminate the entire Jewish nation. If Saul would have obeyed God, this incident would never be recorded. This Agagite wouldn't have been around. And all the king's servants who were within the king's gate bowed and paid homage to Haman, for so the king commanded concerning him. But Mordecai would not bow or pay homage. I like that. This guy's got guts. If you didn't bow, you could get snuffed. Mordecai didn't care. He's not going to bow to Haman, this guy who hated the Jews. And the king's servants who were within the king's gate said to Mordecai, why do you transgress the king's command? Now it happened, when they spoke to him daily, and he would not listen to them, that they told it to Haman to see whether Mordecai's words would stand, for Mordecai told them that he was a Jew. When Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow or pay homage, Haman was filled with wrath. But he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him of the people of Mordecai. Instead, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, the people of Mordecai. Look at verse 8. Haman said to King Ahasuerus, there is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from all other peoples. They do not keep the king's laws. Therefore, it is not fitting for the king to let them remain. Now, Ahasuerus does not investigate the situation. He just listens to hearsay. Haman says, kill the Jews. Ahasuerus says, all right, here's my signet ring. It's done. Let me tell you probably why I think this happened. Ahasuerus has just suffered defeat in a war. Now, you who are in the military can appreciate the fact that a war is very costly to any nation, especially if you're defeated. They were suffering probably financially. The fact that a certain people group who were causing trouble could be eliminated and we can capitalize on all of their finances, all of their spoil, would help the kingdom financially. It was a smart financial political move, typical of an ancient ruler, a despot who was not concerned about the affairs of his people, but only of his own neck, basically. Look at verse 13. Look what happens. And letters were sent by the couriers into all the king's provinces to destroy, to kill, to annihilate all the Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day, on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, to plunder their possessions. Now, there's 127 provinces. There's no telephones, no computers, no newspapers like we have them, teletype, no TV satellites. You have got to get the word out all the way from India through the Fertile Crescent down to Egypt, through, down to Ethiopia, Asia Minor, and parts of Eastern Europe. That in one day, all of the people in the provinces who are Jewish are going to be exterminated. That's a big job. It requires a lot of manpower, a lot of foot power. Guys had to get on their horses, translate the law into 127 dialects and languages, go into all the laundromats, and post on the bulletin board the fact that on a certain day, all the Jews are going to get killed. The law goes out. It's time now for the extermination of the Jews. Anti-Semitism is legalized. There is a supernatural reason, by the way, for anti-Semitism. Prejudice against the Jew is not ordinary prejudice. It is not like hating a black man, although I am not for that at all. That's sin. All prejudice is sin. Anti-Semitism, however, goes a step beyond just normal human prejudice. It is directly programmed from Satan. Because the Jewish people have been the caretakers of the scriptures. The laws of God came through the Jewish nation. The promise of the Messiah came through the Jewish nation. Jesus was born of the seed of David, a Jew. The rest of God's prophetic plan rests upon the existence of a nation. Let me pose to you a hypothetical question. The question is being posed from Satan's way of thinking. If God has so outlined his plan of redemption of the world, let me phrase it another way. If God's plan of redemption depended upon the existence of a race of people and the continuation of that race of people, if you could then exterminate that race of people, obliterate them from off the face of the earth, you will have in effect defeated God. And so the promise in the garden came to the serpent. The seed of the woman will come and crush your head. And from that point on, there has been a battle going on ever since to keep the seed of the woman from being born, the Messiah. Now, as history goes on, more information is released. The Messiah will be of the line of the tribe of Judah, from the lineage of King David. He will be born in Bethlehem, under the royal line of the kings. Well, look at history. Pharaoh tries to exterminate the Jews. Athaliah in the book of 2 Chronicles tries to destroy all of the men and kings of the line of the tribe of Judah. All of the infants in Bethlehem are commanded to be killed when Jesus was born. At every turn of events where God is working, Satan is there to counteract the birth of the Messiah to the extermination of many parts or all of the Jewish race. Let's just exterminate the Jews in Egypt before they can get out of Pharaoh's clutches. Then the Messiah can't be born. The scriptures can't be written. And you can follow that progression, that battle, all the way through history, up to the present day. There is still a worldwide anti-Semitism. It's interesting to note, though, that every nation that's come against Israel is no longer a great nation like it used to be. Egypt, who once governed the whole world. Israel went to Egypt's funeral. Germany, Adolf Hitler. Babylon, Persia. God says, whoever touches you touches the apple of my eye. Now, chapter 4 we went through this morning. Mordecai heard what happened. He instructs Queen Esther, who had become a little callous. Now, I'm briefly going to go over chapter 4 because we covered it this morning, and you could get the tape if you want to fill in the details. I want to draw your attention to verse 13. Mordecai told them to answer Esther, who really didn't want to be involved in this whole situation. Do not think in your heart you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews, for if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this? In other words, maybe this is your time, Queen Esther. Maybe the whole reason God allowed you to become the queen, perhaps it's so that you could intervene and plead for the Jews. Perhaps God has arranged your life and set up the sequence of events for this time. This is your time. Act on it. But the other lesson we find in this verse is the plan and purpose of God is never thwarted. He says, you know, Esther, if you refuse to get involved, then deliverance will arise from another quarter, from another place. That is, if you flake out and refuse to be used by God, God will bypass you and he'll find somebody else who is willing to do his work. God's work's going to get done. And if you refuse to do it, God will find somebody who will say, Lord, use me, I want to go. You say, but I'm qualified. God doesn't care. God wants available people. People who are willing to say what Esther said in verse 16. Go gather the Jews who are present in Shushan and fast for me. Don't eat or drink for 3 days, day or night. My maids and I will fast likewise, so I will go to the king, which is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. What have I got to lose, she said. If I die, I die. I'm a Jew. If I hold my peace, all the Jews are going to be killed. I'll be killed. So it's do or die. If I don't do anything, I'll die. If I go before the king and it's illegal and he's bummed out, I'll die. But I'm going to die anyway. But there may be a chance that he'll listen to me, so I may not die. I might as well try it. So she tries it. And it works. And we see again God's providence. Oh, I hope you've seen God's providence as you've read the scriptures. I hope you've noticed the providence of God in the birth of Jesus Christ. When Caesar Augustus was signing that tax initiative bill, saying that everybody should revert back to their own hometown from their own lineage and pay taxes, if someone would have stood over his shoulder and said, do you know, Caesar Augustus, that by signing this little decree that you're causing a Jewish husband and wife by the name of Mary and Joseph to go to Bethlehem because they live in Nazareth and the scripture says the Messiah is going to be born in Bethlehem and they're the couple that are going to give birth. She is anyway. She's going to conceive and bear Jesus. And the only way that she could get to Bethlehem is by you signing this tax bill. You're fulfilling scripture that was written 100 years ago. He would have probably laughed and said, I don't know anything about babies and prophecy. I'm interested in taxes, that's all. But God's providence made sure that the chain of events were set up as God predicted. Now it happened on the third day that Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace. Now she's getting serious. The first time when she went before King Ahasuerus, she went in her natural beauty. Remember her advisor said, hey man, you're good looking. You're naturally gorgeous. You don't need all the makeup. Just go in and go for it. But now, she is probably putting on the nicest dress and just, she wants to make sure that the king's going to take notice of her because she's going to plead for the Jews' lives. And so she stands in the courtyard and the king sees her. And the king raises up his golden scepter, which means you can come in. If the king wouldn't have raised up the golden scepter, the men would have grabbed her and cut her head off, depending on if he's in a good mood or a bad mood. He was in a good mood. Lifted up the scepter. She approached him. And he said, "Oh, Esther, you're beautiful. What can I do for you? You name it. I'll give you whatever you want up to half the kingdom." She says, "All right, I have a request." She plays it cool. She says, "Command that a feast be given. I want to have a party. And I want you to be there, and I'll be there, and I want Haman to be there. So let's invite Haman. He's a special guest of yours." The king says, "Hey, that's what you want? Fine." She says, "Now I'll tell you the rest later on. But just for now, let's have a feast, and I'll tell you what I'm getting at." There is a lesson that I see in this. I don't want to get over-spiritual or over-spiritualized, but the law of the Medes and the Persians was irrevocable. What has been written was written. If the king did not lift up the censer, the golden little golden stick that he had, death was proclaimed. If he would lift up that little golden rod, life would be granted to the individual to approach. Now, the death sentence had been passed for the queen. She's a Jew. She's going to die. That's the decree. The death sentence is firm. But he lifts up the golden rod and she is able to enter. So it is with the Lord. There's been an irrevocable law given by God. The soul that sins, it shall surely die. Now, a lot of people don't believe that. Yeah. That's old stuff, man. That's passé. God didn't judge sinners. That's ancient medieval thought. Yet, your belief in judgment, your belief in God does not hinder God one bit. It's because you don't believe in him doesn't mean God's going to go away or that judgment day will go away. You will stand before God one day and you will have to give an account. And let's say you're right. Let's say there is no judgment. Let's say there is no eternal reckoning. And we're wrong. I'd still rather be wrong and have the abundant. If this is a joke, if Christianity is a big joke, a big facade, it's the best facade I've ever been on. I wouldn't trade it for the world. The peace and the joy and the purpose that's in my life, I still wouldn't trade it. But if we're right and you're wrong, you've got the worst end of the deal. Because you'll stand before God who will make you give an account. And you can snarl at God all you want. God's not going to pout or go away. You're not going to change the purpose and the plan of eternal God. You're only determining your own destiny by your choice now. The soul that sins, it shall die, but God has raised up that golden scepter of grace. And he said, "Come and live." You can stay out in the outer court and go, "No, I don't believe in it." Fine. You seal your own fate. But God has raised up that scepter and he said, "Come, live. You don't have to die." She calls for this feast. She has the feast. But at the feast, according to chapter 5, she doesn't tell the king what's going on. She's a little bit scared. And we read about it over in verse 7 and 8. She goes, "Now if I have, you know, found favor in your sight," and Haman was there hanging out, "let's have another banquet." He said, "Okay, we'll have another banquet." She's scared to tell the king what's going on. There's a delay. She doesn't tell the king that she's a Jew, that the Jews are about to be exterminated, and that she's pleading for their life. She's possibly scared. For whatever reason, she doesn't tell the king there's a delay. You say, "Oh, what a pity." No, perfect timing. This delay is another part of God's providence. Perfect timing. Follow the story with me. Verse 9. Haman went out that day joyful and with a glad heart. He thought, "Oh, great. You know, I've been invited to this special luncheon. And it's just been me and the queen and the king. I must be a pretty special character." And he's all excited that he is a special man. But as he goes out, he sees Mordecai again by the gate, who won't bow to him. And he's furious. He goes, I could deck that guy. But he restrains himself. He figures, "I'll get him later on." And goes home to his wife and his friends and tells them all that's going on. And here he tells about the fly in his ointment. Verse 13, "Yet all this avails me nothing so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. And his wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, "Let a gallows be made 75 feet high." And in the morning, suggested to the king that Mordecai be hanged on it, and then go merrily with the king to the banquet. And the king, this thing pleased Haman, so he had a gallows made. That night, the king could not sleep. So one was commanded to bring the book of records of the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. Now, this is what I mean by providence. God's providence is different than the miraculous. Now, God works in miracles. A miraculous event is where God intercepts the ordinary events. He intercedes dramatically. A healing, a legitimate healing, is miraculous. It just is not an ordinary occurrence. But God does also work in providence, where he manipulates the ordinary events so that the end result is his will. Divine manipulation of ordinary events. It just so happened that Queen Esther became the queen. It just so happened that Mordecai hasn't been rewarded for what he did. It just so happened that this king couldn't sleep one night. It didn't just so happen. It was divine manipulation. Now, for some reason or another, the king couldn't sleep. Now, what do you do when you can't sleep? You figure out some way to get back to sleep. And so he has the board meeting minutes read of the kingdom. And you want boring reading material, just read some business notes and business, the Chronicles of the Kingdom. I can't sleep. Would you bring in those boring meeting minutes and read them to me? I'm tired. I have insomnia. I want to sleep. I said, sure. As they're reading the Chronicles, they tell him something that's escaped his mind. He has escaped his notice. That there was a plot to kill him by two fellas, Bigthan and Teresh. And it was intercepted by a guy named Mordecai. And the king goes, "You're kidding. These guys wanted to kill me? Mordecai saved my life? Hey, what have we done for Mordecai? Has he been rewarded?" And they looked. They said, "No. Nothing. They haven't promoted him, didn't give him any money or anything." Now, he's trying to figure out the best way to reward Mordecai. And so he says, "Is there anybody else I can consult with in the palace?" Now, let's pick up the narrative right there. The king said, "Who's in the court?" Now, Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace. He'd gotten there probably very early in the morning. He couldn't sleep either. And notice why he's there, to suggest that the king hang Mordecai on the gallows, for he had prepared for him. You see, this is providence, God standing in the shadows manipulating the events. The king's servant said to him, "Haman is there standing in the court." And the king said, "Let him in." And so Haman came in, and the king asked him, "What shall be done for the man whom the king delights to honor?" Now Haman thought in his heart, "Whom would the king delight to honor more than me?" I love this. He's totally unaware that he's speaking of Mordecai, the guy he wants to kill. The king says, "I want to reward Mordecai." So he says, "I want to reward somebody who's great and special to me. What should I done?" Haman goes, "He must be talking about me. I mean, after all, I am God's gift to the world." So he brings out his request. He says, "For the man whom the king delights to honor, let a royal robe be brought, which the king has worn, a horse on which the king has ridden, and a royal crest placed on his head. Then let the robe and horse be delivered to the hand of one of the king's most noble princes, that he may array the man the king delights to honor, parade him on horseback through the city square, and proclaim before him, 'Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor.'" And the king said to Naaman, "Good idea! Hasten and take the robe and a horse as you have suggested, and do so for Mordecai the Jew. You be the one to parade him around the city." What a blow. Haman does it, and he goes back and tells his wife and his friends again. He goes, "I can't believe it. You wouldn't believe what happened." And they tell him, "Something's wrong, Haman. Doesn't look good for you." And just as he's complaining, knock on the door. It's time for the second feast. Esther says, "Let's have a feast." Brings Haman and the king to the second feast. Remember, she hasn't told the king her request yet. So there's now a second feast, and Haman is brought. And for the third time, the king says, what do you want me to do for you, Esther? What's your request? Up to half the kingdom, I'll give it to you. You name it, it's yours. Now, this gal better act soon. This is the third time the king says, I'll give you half my kingdom. And Queen Esther said, if I have found favor in your sight, verse 3 of chapter 7, O king, if it pleases the king, let my life be given at my petition and my people at my request. For we have been sold, my people and I, to be destroyed, to be killed, to be annihilated. Had we been sold as male and female slaves, I would have held my tongue, although the enemy could never compensate the king's loss. Now, the king was shocked. He thought, what are you talking about? Someone wants to kill you and your people? He didn't know she was a Jew yet. Haman didn't know she was a Jew yet. And Haman's probably, because he's not aware of all that goes on in this huge kingdom, thinking, what's she talking about, man? He's probably totally unaware. And verse 6, she gets to the clincher. You know, the king says, well, who's the guy that wants to kill you? And Esther said, the adversary is an enemy, is this wicked Haman. So Haman was terrified before the king and queen. Now, the king gets up from the table. He's shocked. He goes out on the balcony. He's got to think this thing over. Because it's sort of a battle between his right-hand man, Haman, whom he exonerated, and his own wife. He doesn't know who to believe. He goes back in the room and he sees Haman laying basically on his wife, pleading for his life, and he thinks it's an attack on his wife. And he says in verse 8, will he also assault the queen while I'm in the house? As the word left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. And Harbona, one of the eunuchs, said to the king, look, the gallows 50 or 75 feet high, 50 cubits, which Haman made for Mordecai. Hang him on it. So they hanged Haman, verse 10, on the gallows he prepared for Mordecai, that the king's wrath subsided. Love it. Now, I know we're a couple minutes past time. I'm going to finish the book, not verse by verse. I'm going to tell you what happens. And the reason that it's laid out in the last few chapters is to show the turn of events for the Jews. We still are faced with a major problem. Esther is saved. Haman is dead, but there's still been the decree. And remember, all those guys on horseback went through 127 provinces saying, kill the Jews. How do you revoke that? Now, this is the one case in which the king of Persia revokes his orders, gives his signet ring to Mordecai, whom he gives a promotion to, after Esther says, look, this is my uncle, we're relatives, we're both Jews. The king says, here's my signet ring. Here, man, you have a blank check. Do whatever you need to do to stop this thing. Now, how do you suppose you revoke an order after you've sent horsemen throughout all the kingdom? Do it again. Translate it again into 127 languages. Get men on fast horses. And in chapter 8, it says they got the fastest steeds and the most noble people to ride through the kingdom of Persia to Asia Minor, down to Ethiopia, through the Fertile Crescent, and to reverse the decision. Not only did they do that, but because Haman had this wicked plot, there was 500 enemies of the Jews who were ready to pounce on the Jews in Shushan, the palace, at the command of Haman. And so 500 of these conspirators were killed. And as we see the book coming to an end, Mordecai is raised up. He is given the position that Haman had as sort of vice president over the empire. Haman is killed. His enemy Mordecai is raised up. Esther is still the queen. The enemies of the Jews are annihilated, and they have to annihilate two groups of them. In chapter 9, it describes the death of the tormentors. And I want you to look at a couple verses in chapter 9, verse 18. But the Jews who were at Shushan assembled together on the 13th day as well as the 14th day. And the 15th day, they rested and made it a day of feasting and gladness. Verse 20 says, and Mordecai wrote these things and sent letters to all the Jews who were in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, both near and far, to establish among them that they should celebrate yearly the 14th and 15th days of the month of Adar, as the days which the Jews had rest from their enemies, a month which was turned from sorrow to joy for them, and from mourning to a holiday, that they should make them days of feasting and joy, of sending of presents to one another, and gifts to the poor. Verse 26. So they called these days Purim, after the name Pur, which means lot. Therefore, because of all the words of this letter, which they had seen concerning this matter and what had happened to them, the Jews established and imposed it upon themselves and their descendants, and all who joined them, that without fail should celebrate this 2 days every year according to the written instructions and according to the prescribed time. Verse 29. Queen Esther, the daughter of Abihail, with Mordecai the Jew, wrote with full authority to confirm this letter about Purim. Purim, or as we would say, Purim, is one of the feasts that is still kept by the Jews. When I first went to live in Israel, and I went to live on the kibbutz, I got there the day after Purim ended, and the whole dining hall was decorated with beautiful tinsel and presents, and they made faces. They make fun of Haman, basically, that day. Even to this day, they poke fun at Haman. And they have certain pastries that they bake. Oh, man, the pastries that they bake at Purim are awesome. Man, when I get to go to Israel in the Feast of Purim, what are they called, Renee? Amankash? Amantashen, thank you. Anyway, they're little pastries. They're little triangular pastries that are just amazing. You get lots of holy calories when you go over there at Purim. And chapter 10 concludes that King Ahasuerus imposed tribute on the land and the islands of the sea, and all the acts of his power and his might, and the account of the greatness of Mordecai to which the king advanced him, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia? For Mordecai, or Mordecai, the Jew, was second to Ahasuerus, and was great among the Jews, and well received by the multitude of his brethren, seeking the good of his people and speaking peace to his kindred. Now, can you believe it? We covered all of the book. This needs to go down in the Chronicles of Calvary Chapel that Skip finished this many chapters. An interesting side note, according to one group of radical Jews that sprung up between the Testaments, they believed that in the end times, all of the Old Testament scriptures will pass away except the Torah, the first five books of Moses, and the book of Esther, as an eternal symbol of God vindicating the Jews as his chosen people. Now, I don't agree with that, but certainly you can see through this book God's providence in overruling even the nasty events of your own life. Mordecai could have sulked because he wasn't rewarded, but he got his reward, more incredible than he ever imagined. Now unto him who is able to do exceedingly abundantly above all that we can ask or think. The main message of this book is that God stands in the shadows, overruling the events of history, and will overrule the events of your life as you commit your life to him. Who knows but that God has not brought you to the kingdom for such a time as this? There are ordained appointments in our lives. When I first came to New Mexico, first 6 months were tough. I missed my friends. I missed the beach. I missed the palm trees. I complained. You can ask Mark. When it came time for March and it started to be windy, man, I was nasty around the office. I can't stand this wind. But I remembered a year before that, and he remembers quite well. After being here 6 months, I was ready to move back to California. I said, I think the Lord's calling me back. Because we all went there for Christmas, and you remember it was so warm and 75 degrees in December. People were wearing shorts, and I said, yes, I don't know why I left. The Lord is calling me back. And I had promised the Lord that I'd stay in Albuquerque at least a year, and I'd be a fisher of men. I'd fish in this pond for a year. And after 6 months, I was ready to throw in the towel because of the weather. I was so bummed out. Oh, it's brown and it's this and that. Now I love it. I even love the weather. I love, especially after going back to the smog, I can't wait to come back here. But I remember being ready to quit, and God spoke to my heart and he said, you owe me 6 months, pal. And I said, Lenya, I promised the Lord I'd be here a year. I've only given him 6 months. I'm going to stay. It was in that 6 months that this fellowship exploded. And the Lord showed me that he brought me here for such a time as this. That there's prescribed things that God wants to do in our lives. And sometimes God just says, hang in there. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we thank you for divine election and for providence. That you control events. That you move kings, as Daniel said. As David said, the nations are a drop in the bucket to you. You are the potentate, the sovereign king, the ruler over the earth. We give you control over our lives, thanking you not only for the lessons we see in this book, but for the many appointments that you have put in our path, changing the events of our history and doing a work through our lives. Lord, we submit ourselves to you. Use our lives, and may our attitude be, if I perish, I perish. In Jesus' name, amen.